York, I think that was a pretty good mini sermon. Maybe the maxi sermon will be okay too. So. I appreciate the encouragement. One of the things that, and I can't put my mind into the mind of the songwriter, but there what says, I will sing the new song. If you trace references to the new song throughout the Old Testament and New Testament, that term was used whenever there was a new deliverance from some enemy or whatever the case may be. In the book of Revelation, they're singing the new song for their deliverance from the oppressor, from Rome and the persecution. Well, the reason he says a new song is that there will be that final deliverance. There will be yet another deliverance. Our deliverance from sin, finally and completely, from this world, delivered into a much better place. So I think those words within that song are indeed very powerful. Okay, tonight we're resuming our study on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. This is lesson 4 in the series. It's been a couple of weeks since we delved into all of this, so let's do just a very quick review of some things covered in the previous lessons. First of all, in lesson number 1, we outlined 3 major objectives for this study, and we'll come back to those in just a moment. We gave 3 reasons for why this study is so very important. And we discussed both the wrong way and the right way to settle issues on divorce and remarriage. And again, those outlined sermons are all available on the website if you miss any of those and need to do some review. In lesson number 2, we read all of the passages that seem to have the most bearing on these subjects of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. We felt like we needed to get all the information out there, certainly before we started drawing any conclusions about what Jesus teaches on these subjects. In lesson number 3, we hopefully, at least in some measure, accomplished objective number 1, and that is to see both marriage and divorce through the eyes of God. Sure, there are passages that explicitly state that God absolutely hates or abhors divorce. But we better understand why He abhors divorce so much when we understand what He says about marriage. When we see marriage through His eyes, it's then that we can see just how detestable divorce actually is. And then we also accomplished objective number 2 by answering the question, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? We set out in the beginning that this was going to be one of the questions that we wanted to answer. That's the very question that was asked to Jesus. And the answer that was given was a resounding no. What God has joined together, let not man separate. Jesus gives one cause for divorce. One cause for divorce, and that is adultery. That is what we were able to see from the passages under consideration. All right, in lesson number 4 tonight, the first 2 objectives will still be in play. We're going to still deal with some of that. But we also tonight want to hopefully accomplish objective number 3. And that is to answer the question, who can marry again lawfully? Or who can marry again with God's approval? And what we plan to do is to visually illustrate, and you'll understand what I mean by that here in just a few minutes, but to visually illustrate what is taught in the following passages. These are the passages that have the most bearing specifically on this idea of remarriage. Who can marry again with God's approval? We're going to be looking at Romans 7, 1 through 4, the passage that Daniel just read a few minutes ago, Mark 10, 11 and 12, Luke chapter 16 and verse 18, Matthew 19, 3 through 9, and then finally in 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 through 15. Now, you may recall in the introductory lesson to this whole series, I said that there are all along some very complicated scenarios that people find themselves in regard to marriages and divorces and so forth. And we said at the time that while the teaching of Jesus is pretty straightforward on this entire subject, in some of those situations, it's a little difficult to know how to apply that simple teaching to this complicated scenario over here. But I want to make it clear here at the beginning tonight, we're not going to deal, at least tonight, with all the what-if scenarios. We want to just try our best to discover, find out, the basic teaching that is presented in these passages. There'll be time later to deal with some of the thorny issues and even with some of the false teaching that surrounds these subjects. So, divorce and remarriage, visually illustrated. Let's start with Romans chapter 7. Let's go ahead and read the passage first so that we'll understand what is presented from here. Romans chapter 7, and you'll discover very quickly that the main subject here is not marriage. The main subject has to do with being dead to the law or free from the law of Moses so that we might marry Christ. He says we can't be married to both of them at the same time. We can't be married to the law of Moses and married to Christ. But he uses an analogy in here concerning marriage. And it teaches a very important principle. In fact, there's a principle in here that I believe we'll be able to see that everything else that is said on marriage and divorce by Jesus really goes back to this underlying principle. Romans 7, beginning with verse 1. Or do you not know, brethren, for I speak to those who know the law, that the law has dominion over a man as long as he lives? For the woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. But if the husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. So then, if while her husband lives, she marries another man, she will be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is free from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she has married another man. Therefore, my brethren, you also have become dead to the law through the body of Christ, that you may be married to another, to him who was raised from the dead, that we should bear fruit to God. And so let's illustrate what is taught here in this passage. Let's say you've got Bill and Sue who get married to each other. They are bound together for life. He says here in the passage that a woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. And of course, that would be true vice versa. All right. But let's say while Bill is still alive, Sue divorces him and marries Tom. What, according to the passage we just read, do we call Sue? We call her an adulteress. And of course, Tom would be involved in that adultery with her. And it's not hard to see why that is the case, because why? She is still bound to her husband. She is still bound to Bill as long as he lives. Now, I know some of you are thinking, yeah, but there are, Jesus talks about an exception. We're going to deal with the exception later. Okay, we're looking at the general rule here at the beginning. We'll deal with the exception over in Matthew 19 a little bit later. All right, same scenario though. And let's say Bill, rest in peace, Bill has passed away. Now, Sue marries Tom. What does the passage say? Is she free now to marry Tom, now that her husband has passed away? What the passage says is that she shall no longer be an adulteress. She is not an adulteress. She is free from the law of her husband to marry Tom. And so everything is fine with that. Okay, so again, that's the very simple principle set out here in Romans 7, 1 through 4. All right, now let's go to Mark chapter 10. Mark chapter 10, verses 11 and 12. So he said to them, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if a woman divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. Again, that's pretty straightforward, but let's look at it visually so that we have no questions about what is said. Bill and Sue get married to each other. If Bill divorces Sue and then marries Jill, what is Bill doing, according to this passage? Bill divorces Sue and marries another. He marries Jill. According to what Jesus says here, Bill is committing adultery. And of course, Jill would be committing adultery together with him. So it deals with it from the man's standpoint in verse 11, right? Now it kind of flips it around in verse 12. It talks about the woman divorcing the man. Just in case we are wondering, well, would the same apply if the woman took the initiative and filed the divorce? So Sue marries Bill. Sue gets divorced. Or Sue files for divorce against Bill, divorces him. And then Sue marries another, marries Tom. What is Sue doing? She's committing adultery. And of course, Tom would be committing adultery with her. That's pretty simple, isn't it? Do we all see what is taught here in this passage? Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. If a woman divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. That's illustrated here on the screen. Now, what have we not considered up to this point? We have not considered the one who is divorced. What about that person? What about that person should they decide to get married again? Well, that's not specifically dealt with here in Mark 10, 11 and 12. But it is dealt with in the next passage. Luke 16 and verse 18. Luke chapter 16 and verse 18. Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. Now we illustrated that part, didn't we, with the previous passage there in Mark chapter 10. And whoever marries her who is divorced from her husband commits adultery. You see how a new element is brought into play here in Luke 16 in verse 18. Alright, so Bill and Sue get married. Bill divorces Sue. And then Bill, of course, decides to get remarried. He marries Jill. They are both guilty of adultery. All right, now what about the one who is divorced? We know Bill's situation. Bill divorced Sue. He married again. He's committing adultery with Jill. What about the one who is divorced? In this case, Sue. Well, let's say that Tom marries Sue. after she has been divorced from Bill. What are they both guilty of? They're both guilty of adultery. Now, you may recall that in the previous lesson about divorce, we were talking about one of the reasons that God hates it is because it can lead to more and more sin. And so, you see how we've got four people now involved in adultery. You see how serious this whole matter is. But again, that's what is plainly taught here in Luke 16, in verse 18. All right, now let's look at Matthew 5. There's a very interesting element that is brought out here, and we talked about this some in the previous lesson when we were particularly concentrating on divorce. Matthew 5, verses 31 and 32. Furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. All right? Bill marries Sue. I keep using those same two people. And let's say he divorces her for any reason except sexual immorality. We're taking that cause off the table here. Whatever reason he gave for divorcing her, it was not for sexual immorality. Alright? Over here on the other side, we've got Bill, who is yet unmarried. But Sue, the lady that he has divorced, marries Tom. All right, what is the status of Sue according to what we just read here in Matthew chapter 5? She's committing adultery. And Tom is committing adultery with her. But now, what does Jesus say about Bill? What does Jesus say about Bill in this situation? What he says is that Bill has caused the sin of Sue and Tom. How about that? And that's really what he's talking about there when he says causes her to commit adultery. It doesn't mean that upon her divorcing her, she automatically at that point is guilty of adultery. He's anticipating what typically happens is that she will marry again. And what he's saying is that Bill bears some responsibility in that. We don't want to soften the words of Jesus here. That's what he causes her to commit adultery. So, let's think about Bill a little bit more, though. Let's think about what Bill has done. Bill has failed to honor the commitment that he made to his wife. Bill has failed to meet all the obligations that the Lord has imposed upon him as a husband. Bill has sinned by divorcing Sue. Remember, that's one of the points we tried to establish in the previous lesson. Divorce itself is sinful unless it is for the cause of fornication. And now on top of that, Bill has caused the sin of Sue and Tom. Now, if that's not enough reason to give someone pause and say, hey, wait a minute, I know you're looking to get a divorce here, but you better stop right now and think about all that you're fixing to do. The wrong that you're going to be committing in doing this and the wrong that it's going to lead to. And so, again, that's what's taught here in Matthew 5, verses 31 and 32. All right, let's go on to Matthew chapter 19. Matthew 19. And we're going to read just through verse 8 now, verses 3 through 8. Now, in a minute, we'll deal specifically with verse 9. But the reason we're just reading verses 3 through 8 right now is we want to read just the part where Jesus answers the original question posed to him. The original question had nothing to do with remarriage. It was just simply, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? Well, let's pick up now with verse 4, because the question is asked in verse 3. And he answered and said to them, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore what God has joined together, let not man separate. They said to him, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? He said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. So let's look at what is basically set out here in what we've just read in verses 3 through 8. Here's Bill and Sue, married to each other. And we know that they are joined together by God. That's the language that's used here. We've also seen the language in Romans chapter 7 about them being bound to each other. The wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives. They're joined together by God. And so what's the basic teaching of Jesus here? Two people are married. They're joined together by God. The basic teaching here is no divorce allowed. The resounding answer that he gives there is what God has joined together, let not man separate. Now again, we're working toward the exception. But always remember, wherever there's an exception, there has to be a general rule. We have to make sure we distinguish between those. Let's make sure we understand the general rule first, what God desires, and then deal with the exception. All right, so now let's go to Matthew 19 and verse 9. Let's read that verse together. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. Alright? Here we have Bill and Sue again, joined together by God in marriage. Let's say that Bill divorces Sue for just any reason. Not sexual immorality now. We'll deal with that in just a minute. Just for any reason. All right, what do we have here? Well, Bill then marries Jill. They are both guilty of adultery. Sue, the one who was divorced by Bill, if she marries Tom, then again, these two are guilty of adultery. And we've seen that in some of the previous passages already. So once again, you see a scenario where you have four people involved in adultery. Again, that's how serious all of this can potentially be. All right, but now let's bring the cause of sexual immorality into play. Again, Bill and Sue married, joined together by God. Bill divorces Sue because of sexual immorality. Well, let's see. What happens if Bill marries again? Can Bill marry again? Lawfully? With God's approval? Whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. So if he divorces her for sexual immorality and marries another, he does not commit adultery. And so that's what we have here. Bill, after divorcing Sue for sexual immorality, marries Jill. There's no adultery involved in here. Again, I believe that's clearly what Jesus is allowing here in this passage. All right, now what about Sue? Sue was divorced for adultery. Now, there are those who would teach that whenever adultery occurs, that the marriage bond is completely broken and both of them are now free to marry. Is that how you read the passage? What I would like for you to observe is that the exception is not applied there at the end, is it? It doesn't say whoever marries her who is divorced except for sexual immorality commits adultery. The exception is not applied to the end. We might say it this way, Jesus does not give the guilty party the right to remarry. And so Sue, who was divorced because of sexual immorality, if she marries Tom, then they are committing adultery together. Again, I believe, the simple teaching that Jesus gives here in Matthew 19. All right, now let's move on to 1 Corinthians 7. Some special scenarios dealt with here. At least we'll look at some of those in just a minute. 1 Corinthians 7. And let's just look at verses 10 and 11. We'll go a little bit farther here in just a minute. 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 and 11. Now to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord. A wife is not to depart from her husband. But even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And a husband is not to divorce his wife. Now, we're going to deal with the remain unmarried or be reconciled in just a minute, but there's a couple of phrases, a couple of imperatives that we want to pick out from this before we get into all of that. Here we have Bill and Sue again, married to each other. What the Scriptures teach, what Jesus says is, Sue, do not depart from Bill. And what Jesus says to Bill is, Bill, do not divorce Sue. You notice the force of those? A wife is not to depart from her husband. A husband is not to divorce his wife. And so before we get into any of the other scenarios presented here, let's make sure we pick those two imperatives out and understand the force of those. Now, does this sound similar to what we've read in these other passages? Right. It just further strengthens what we have seen in some of the other passages. All right, but there are some other things dealt with in this passage. Now, let's deal with verse 11 in particular here. Verse 11, just to read it again. But even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. All right, so we've got Bill and Sue again. Sue divorces Bill. Well, what the passage says here, what verse 11 specifically says, Sue, you need to remain unmarried or be reconciled to your husband. Now, I want you to think about something for just a minute. Are these two options equal? Was she supposed to get a divorce in the first place? There's nothing said here about sexual immorality. Was Sue supposed to get a divorce in the first place? And the answer is no. Did Sue sin by getting a divorce? Yes, she did. And so her first effort should be toward what? Where should the priority lie? In being reconciled to her husband. I did wrong, and I need to get back together with him. Now, I realize that sometimes the person that you divorce, they get married right away, and sometimes it can be rendered impossible to do so. They won't take you back. Okay? But understand, this is the first priority. I've done wrong here. I need to make this right. I need to get back. Now, if he can't do that, what other option does he give? To remain unmarried. You're not free to marry another. And we ought to have been able to see that from what was taught in the other passages. But now somebody says, okay, but certainly he seems to be allowing for that there in verse 11. But even if she does depart, isn't that like granting her permission to do so? Well, you really think that's the way we ought to read that? Look at a couple of other passages with me. Galatians chapter 5, where very similar wording is used. Galatians chapter 5. Beginning in verse 14. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even in this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, beware lest you be consumed by one another. Is he giving them permission to bite and devour one another? Obviously not. He gives an imperative. He gives a command. Here's the way I want you to behave. But now, if you don't, here are the results of that. Look in 1 John 2 and verse 1. Perhaps this is a better illustration. 1 John 2 and verse 1. My little children, these things I write to you so that you may not sin. And if anyone sins, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. So, is he given permission to sin? If anyone sins. No, he just got through saying, I'm writing these things so that you won't sin. But he's making provisions for what happens when a person does sin. Remember this advocate that you have with the Father, that is Jesus Christ. So let's be careful how we read the "even if she does depart" in this passage. And again, as we've already said, her departure from him in the first place is a sin. We're not going to go back and read through these passages again. We've, I think, clearly established that already. She's contradicting the teachings of Ephesians 5, Titus 2, and 1 Peter 3. And just to kind of summarize those very quickly, those deal with the obligations of a wife toward her husband. She is neglecting those. She has stopped doing those things, and those are all things expected of her by God. And she's violating the principles of 1 Corinthians 7, verses 3 through 5. If you go up to the first part of this chapter, it talks about husbands and wives meeting each other's needs. And so in many different ways, she has done the wrong thing. So again, he's not giving her permission to divorce here, simply stating the options, if indeed that does happen. All right, now let's read a little bit further there in 1 Corinthians 7. Let's go back to chapter 7, and now let's read verses 12 through 15. But to the rest, I, not the Lord, say, if any brother has a wife who does not believe, and she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. But if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. But God has called us to peace. Well, there's a few different scenarios we need to present here from this passage. Let's say that believer Bill is married to unbeliever Sue. He says, if she, that is the unbeliever, Bill, if she's willing to live with you, do not divorce her. Another scenario. Unbeliever Bill is married to believer Sue. They've swapped roles now. What he says to Sue, who is a Christian, If your unbelieving husband is willing to live with you, do not divorce him. And that's what's set out here in these verses. But now let's look at another scenario. You've got an unbeliever, once again, married to a believer. Let's say the unbeliever divorces the believer. What does he tell the believer in this case? He says, you are not under bondage. You are called to peace. Well, what does that mean? I don't know that I'm entirely certain. But I will say that what is a Christian going to be very conscientious about? Let's say you're talking about a believing husband who is divorced by his unbelieving wife. What's he going to be conscientious about? Well, he's not going to like the idea of this happening in the first place, but he's going to be thinking about, okay, what do I need to do to preserve this? What do I need to do to meet my obligations toward her? There are things the Lord has taught me to do. And what he's saying is you're not under bondage to fulfill those responsibilities to the unbeliever. If they don't want to be with you, if they're going to divorce you, you're not under bondage. Now, does that mean that the believer who was divorced by the unbeliever is now free to marry? Is remarriage really addressed here? I would submit that remarriage is really not addressed until you get down in verse 39, where it talks about after your husband dies or your wife dies, you're free to marry then, but only in the Lord. I don't believe remarriage is addressed here at all. If you think about the passages that we've just read, we're going to have something really crystal clear here in 1 Corinthians 7, granting that believer now the freedom to marry again. And the reason I say we're going to have something crystal clear here to grant that right is because of what we've been studying throughout this lesson tonight. Think about how we've illustrated Matthew 5, 32, 19, 9, the other passages that you see up here. What about the person who is divorced and marries another? What have we consistently seen in those passages? We have seen that that person, upon marrying again, will be committing adultery. I don't see anything in this passage that grants that person. I see now where they're free from the responsibility that they have toward that person, but I don't see any freedom to marry again. I will say as well, sometimes people make a big deal out of the word bondage in here. You're not under bondage. And they'll say, well, that means that they're released from this bond that God has between the husband and the wife. You know, He joins them together. There's a bond that He puts between them. He has glued them together. Now they're free from that bond. Well, I will say that the word here in the original is entirely different. It's from a different set of words from the word bound that's used down in 1 Corinthians 7 in verse 39. A wife is bound by law as long as her husband lives. We're talking about two different words. But I don't know that we necessarily have to get into a battle of which word is used and so forth. Again, if we're going to have something that contradicts what is taught in those other passages, we need something crystal clear here. And we don't have that whatsoever. And so I do not believe the Lord grants that believer who has been divorced by their unbelieving spouse the right to remarry. Okay, that's a look through all the passages. Let me say before I close that I've been working on this lesson for about a month and a half. And I've tried to be very careful with it. If you have spotted anything at all on these charts, if you've heard anything at all in what I've said, that you believe to be in error, please let me know. We'll look at it together, and if I have taught something that's wrong, then I need to correct that. These are serious issues, and these impact people's lives greatly. And I'll tell you the truth, it always scares me to death to preach on this subject. As I said in the introductory lesson, the last thing that I want to do is countenance someone's sin. Say something is okay when it's not okay. But I also, on the other side, I don't want to say that someone's in sin when they're not. I want to be careful with these passages. And again, so if anything that I have presented is in error, please let me know, because we need to, just as publicly as I've said it tonight, I'll issue the correction just as publicly. The invitation of Jesus Christ was open when you walked into the building tonight, and it'll be open when you leave here tonight. It'll be open in the morning if the Lord wills we have another day. In other words, you can respond to the invitation of Christ at any time. But you do have this opportunity right now to become a Christian, to be saved from your sins, to begin that new life as a Christian, and begin that path toward eternal life. If you need to do that tonight, or need to make correction of wrong as an erring Christian, let it be known as we stand and sing.